Hi, I'm Nate, one of the hosts of the Thinking Poker Podcast. If you're new to the show, thanks for checking us out. If you're a longtime listener, thanks for finding us at our new home at Poker News. Make sure you subscribe via pokernews.com/podcast because soon you won't be able to find us at Thinking Poker anymore. We're excited to be part of the Poker News Podcast Network. We don't really intend to change much about the show, just bring it to a wider audience and hopefully open some doors to new guests. If you aren't familiar with the show, welcome. We'd like to take this opportunity to introduce ourselves. Andrew, my co-host, has been a professional poker player for about 10 years. He produces videos for Tournament Poker Edge, and he writes strategy articles for Poker News and 2+2. He also writes the Thinking Poker blog that you can find at www.thinkingpoker.net.
Hi, I'm Andrew. My colleague Nate also has a background as a professional poker player. He's played a bit less in recent years. He's been pursuing a PhD in philosophy and also working as a software engineer for a bioinformatics startup. Together, we host this show, the Thinking Poker Podcast, which we look at as a fresh take on the poker world. Although we've had and will have in the future big name players as guests, it's never our goal just to talk to the latest tournament winner. We like to talk to interesting people who fill all sorts of roles in this fascinating little subculture of ours. The small stakes grinders, the dealers, the reporters, and the nomads. We also talk strategy each week. So if you have a hand that you would like us to discuss, you can send it to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Sometimes we talk about issues relating to ethics or security. Again, if you have questions about those topics, you can send them to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Really, any comments or suggestions of any kind, we'd love to hear them. So please enjoy the show and let us know what you think.
Hello and welcome to episode 79 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me is Nathan Mavis. How are things?
How are you? I'm doing great. How are you?
You know it's the prerogative of the person who does the bring-in to ask the other person how they're doing first.
Yeah, I got excited. Yeah, I think we've both been very excited to podcast these last couple of weeks. It's yeah, everything's good. I'm excited about poker. I'm excited about life. Everything's good. And how are you?
I'm excited about this episode in particular because this one has been, I mean, we've been talking to these people for quite some time. They are from the University of Alberta. And in particular, they are people who have been working for a while on an artificial intelligence that can play limit hold'em, heads up limit hold'em, by most accounts, quite well. So, you know, we actually initially had an opportunity to get in contact with them after we aired our Poker Snowy episode. We got an email from someone else, a different postdoctoral student at the University of Alberta, who said that he was familiar with these people and could maybe put us in touch with them. And this was back in like November or something. And then it's just been until now trying to find a time to schedule it. They actually had some involvement with NBC's Olympics coverage. Apparently they had done some sort of analysis of curling, of all things. And they participated in the way that NBC was presenting their coverage of curling during the Winter Olympics. So that was one of the complications of trying to get in touch with them sooner. But and then we had an interview scheduled that I ended up having to cancel at the last minute for personal reasons. So this interview has really been a long time in the making, but I expect that it's going to be a very interesting one.
Yeah, people like these ones. They liked it when the Poker Snowy guy came on, and yeah, people like this kind of thing. So I'm looking forward to
I like
it too.
This kind of thing.
Yeah, as a geek and a poker player, and somebody who's been hearing sort of more and less informed things about this group for a very long time. I think this group goes back a long way, right? I mean, I guess we'll talk about this with them, but it's an old project, yes?
Yeah, I want to say at least 5 or 6 years.
I want to say I have memories of reading about it on like RGP with like some challenge that they had a long time ago, or that there was like a limit hold'em study group, and that there were these sort of Canadian geniuses who were doing things about it. But I guess I'll ask them about this. But it's one of the older and better projects of its type, and I'm looking forward to it. And so these are, you know, long-standing poker minds, and you're helping bring in the next generation of great poker minds, yes?
Yeah, and we talked, I don't remember what episode it was, but some time ago we had a question about how to teach poker to children, and I actually had an opportunity to do this recently with, I mentioned before, my cousin on the show. He's the one who Carlos and I visited when we were driving to Atlantic City, and he has two sons who I'm relatively close with, who are, they're actually not quite 8 and 5, but they're pretty close. The 7-year-old is about a month away from turning 8, and I think the other one is like, you know, four years old and 9 months or something like that. And these kids have, well, for one thing, I think they're pretty mature or have like a better understanding of, like, their parents have always kind of talked to them as adults and like included them in the stuff that they were doing. Like, one of the reasons why my cousin is interested in farming is because it's a way that he can, you know, be working but also still spend a lot of time around his family, and in I want to emphasize, a very non-exploitative and not child laborish sort of way. He has, you know, included his children in some of the farm work that he's done when he was able to work on a farm. Like when they had a greenhouse, he was able to have the kids like help with just, you know, all you really have to do is like dig a little hole in the dirt with your finger and stick some seeds inside of it. So that was the kind of thing that like young kids could help with a bit. And he's always been big on like explaining to them what, you know, what's happening on the farm and you know what different types of vegetables are. So like these kids know more about vegetables certainly than like your average American would, even at like the age of 4. And likewise with trucks, because their father also works for, I guess it's the Department of Public Works, and you know, so they like know a lot about different types of trucks and can explain to you like how they work and why one type of truck is better than another for a certain job. Again, like far more knowledge than I do, even at the age of 4. Like they're explaining, they can explain to me a lot of things about this sort of stuff. So I, you know, they may be slightly atypical in this sense, but I visited with them recently, and before I got there, I was talking to their mother on the phone, and she was telling me they had gotten a Monopoly game recently, and they didn't really like Monopoly that much, or the younger one got bored with Monopoly very quickly. But at some point, she walked into the room, and they told her that they were playing poker. They didn't have any cards. They just had Monopoly money, so it's really not clear what they were doing or what they thought poker looked like. But you know, I guess they were vaguely, like, I don't think they've ever, they don't have a TV. I don't think they've ever really like seen poker on television or anything. So I'm pretty sure their only exposure to it has been hearing me talk about it in passing. I've never like sat down and talked to them about it, but, you know, they, I'm sure, overhear me talking to their parents, and I've probably mentioned it to them once or twice. So I guess they had just, you know, some idea that poker existed just a result of having heard me talk about it. So I kind of had it on my radar that there was some level of interest that had recently been expressed in poker. So I'd kind of been thinking in the back of my head, you know, how would I, if I were to play poker with one or both of them, how would I try to introduce it to them? So it did actually come up that we played Monopoly for a couple of minutes, and quickly the younger one got bored and said he wanted to play poker instead. So I was like, okay, let's play some poker. So we got the Monopoly money, and initially I had the two of them play heads up against each other, and I didn't really, so what we did, we just played one card poker, meaning they didn't even have regular playing cards, they had an Uno deck, so I took the cards, like numbered 1 through 9, I just got one of each one, so we had a 9-card deck. And I took the cards numbered 1 through 9, I dealt one to each player. I think they started with 20 $100 bills. I had them each ante $100 bill, and then I just told them the rules of the game, and not that I didn't give them any kind of like strategy advice. I just said, you know, your goal is to, you know, show a bigger card than what your opponent has, and if you want to, you can bet, and then the other person has to decide, you know, does he think his card is good enough to call you? Does he think his card is so good that he wants to bet even more? Or if he doesn't like his card very much, he can just fold. And that was all that I told them. So this also, the 4 or 5-year-old quickly got bored with, and he just demonstrated no strategic capacity whatsoever. Like, you know, he called a raise with a deuce, which was, I guess not quite the nut low, but pretty close. you know, all he wanted to do was see showdowns. You know, he was not interested in his betting didn't really seem to have much correspondence to the card that he held, and he really just wanted to like see who had the bigger card. But he did enjoy that for a bit, like in the same way I guess that you might enjoy playing War or some other game where there's no real strategy to it. Like right. Just seeing who had a bigger card and passing the money back and forth was interesting to him for a bit, but he got bored with that pretty quickly.
This is where stud players say that this game resembles Hold'em, right? Anyway, go ahead.
So he wandered off, but I think the 8-year-old, and this is a pretty common dynamic between the two of them, he was sort of frustrated that his little brother wasn't even trying to play well, because he was actually kind of interested in, not that he had like a real advanced grasp of the strategy, but I think like it was not as interesting to him just to see who had the bigger card. And it was frustrating to him that his little brother wasn't playing that well. So once the younger one quit, then I took over for him, and I played a bit against the older one, and we talked, like after every hand, I would talk to him a little bit, or ask him why he did the thing that he did, or something like that. Initially he was playing very straightforward, just raising when he had good cards. I mean, he was also pretty sticky, but he would fold sometimes if he had a very weak card, and he understood not to bet very weak cards, and he was betting in, as you would expect, like in correlation to his hand strength. So if he had a 9, he was betting a lot more than if he had a 6 or something like that. So at one point he bet a very, he made a small bet. Like we'd each answered ante to 100, and he bet something like 200, which indicated to me that he probably had like a 6. And so I decided I would make a huge raise and see what, and I had a deuce. So I wanted to see what he would do if I made a huge raise. So I did make a big raise, and he folded. And I said, we'd been doing everything face up. So he folded face up. And then I showed him that I had a 2, and I explained to him why I did that. And he really likes the idea of like tricking people. He's really into that generally. He likes to like set little traps for people and stuff. So I knew that would appeal to him. Once I told him, I was like, well, what I did was, I pretended like I had a big hand when I actually had a really bad hand, because I thought maybe I could make use of folds and hands that were better than mine. So once I showed him that, then he started taking that into account when we were playing. And there was another instance where I did something very similar. This time I was the first one to act, but I just bet, I think I bet like 1,200, and we did each emptied 100, and I had a 2. And I don't know what he was thinking about, but he tanked for a long time, and he eventually called me with a 4.
So, you got owned.
Yeah, I did. I definitely got owned. I don't know, like what I have no idea, like how sophisticated was his thought process. Like, what, like did he actually put me on like a polarized range, or I don't know what. But I mean, I imagine the fact that I had shown him a bluff previously definitely contributed to him making that call, which I thought was interesting. Now, more interesting than that is that I did the same thing again a couple hands later when I was dealt a 9, which is the nuts, and he folded a 6 face up. So once again, I may have gotten leveled here by an 8-year-old. He also tried to bluff me once, although it was not as... he didn't really demonstrate a good understanding of like sizing or pot odds. We hadn't talked about pot odds at all, and I just didn't think it was going to go over well. So I had bet 400 with a 7, and he just raised 200 more, which I kind of tried to say to him, like, he had a 6. So, which A is like, obviously not really the sort of hand that you'd want to bluff with, but also maybe not a hand that you could really raise for value. Although I guess I would have called with whatever at that point, getting like whatever, 6-1 or something. Anyway, I tried to explain to him that, I was like, well, did you want me to fold, or did you think that you had the best hand? He didn't really seem to have a clear idea on that. I tried to explain to him that, I'm really not going to fold much of anything when there's so much already in there, and it just costs me a little bit more. But I don't think I didn't get the sense that he really understood what I was saying there. The other thing was that he didn't really, I think, like, because once I showed him the bluffing and talked about that, he seemed to get that. What he didn't get as well was value betting. Like, he was pretty happy just to win the pot, no matter how strong. Like, if he raised with a 9 and I folded, he would be like, yes, and take the 200. And right. that like, he was, it didn't really occur to like that,
right.
Yeah,
right,
that
right.
He should be trying to get more from it.
It's fun to see how bright kids react to things, and how, I don't know, it doesn't, not so dissimilar to like my very first attempts to think through the game, right? So like,
no, I mean, I definitely see like only barely more sophisticated reasoning than this at real poker tables sometimes.
Yeah. No, it's fun, and I think it's cool that you can play a very simple poker game that nonetheless has real strategy to it. Like, I don't know the solution to that game off the top of my head, right? So it's nice that it's something that's so accessible to people.
The other thing that got a little interesting was the 4-year-old was still sitting there watching us, and their mother was there as well. So at some point, you know, when we were talking about, like, I kept using the word tricking, like I'm trying to trick you when I made a big raise, or, you know, I'm suggesting that I have a big hand when I actually have a weak hand. And I tried to explain value betting in the same context. Like, you know, it's also trying to trick people, but when you have a strong hand, then you want to try to trick them into thinking that you have a weak hand. So maybe you could try checking with a strong hand or doing something that's like what you would do with a weak hand. And, again, I don't think he really got that concept as much, but I kept using the word tricking. And at some point the mother said to the four-year-old, you know, he's saying tricking, but, you know, it's actually lying, or like something kind of along those lines. And so I kind of tried to explain why I was like, well, you know, I guess in poker, I would say there's not really an expectation of truth telling in the same way. I guess this was actually specifically in the context of table talk, like, cause I also got into, you know, like I would raise 1200 and then I would, you know, say something to him like, oh, you better fold. I've got a pretty strong hand. Like, you know, this kind of stuff like that where, I kind of wanted to see whether he would pick up on the fact that I might be using my words to try to manipulate him, which I think he did understand that. So it was specifically in that context that she was saying, like, the lying versus tricking thing. And so yeah, I was saying, well, I think when you're playing poker, there's not really an expectation of truth-telling in the same way. And so I would distinguish it from just, like, flat-out lying. And her rejoinder to that was, well, you know, when someone lies a lot, you don't always expect them, like, you end up not having an expectation of truth from that person either. But, you know, I would still say that person is lying, which I don't think is an exactly symmetrical situation, but I also didn't have an immediate response to.
Yeah, I think it turns out to be very hard to define lying. The long and short of it is that I don't think that kind of chat in a poker game is, well, table talk is one thing. Like, I certainly don't think that bluffing is a form of lying, which some people do. It turns out to be very hard to define lying. And I do think there would be some kinds of table talk that could be sort of not true, but also, and knowingly not true, but also not lying. But yeah, rather than rehash some of the very long semantic discussions I've had with people, I think I'll leave it at that. But I will relay a story from a card room about a couple of years ago, which was an English as a second language gentleman was playing, and he made a bet on the river, and he got called, and he shrugged, and he said, "Ah, I was joking."
That's awesome.
So that's... All right, let's talk some strategy, huh?
Actually, one other quick funny thing from the conclusion of this. After we finished playing, I asked the 8-year-old. I asked him if he had any, because I was going to be playing poker that night, I had told him. And so I asked him if he had any strategy advice for me, or if he thought that I had done anything wrong. And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, "Sometimes you smile a little bit when you have a really good hand." So I don't know what...
Yeah, whether he actually picked up on anything.
But I was pretty impressed. I didn't really know what to expect from him. I was just curious what he would say when I asked him that. But I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. How often do you get really good coaching from other people, really?
Yeah, especially from 8-year-olds.
Yeah. All right. Time for an ad. Why don't you tell people about TPE?
A quick perusal of the recent videos released on Tournament Poker Edge gives you a good idea of the diversity you can find there. For the small stakes players, new pro Ben Reasons is doing a hand history review of a $5 MTT. Meanwhile, Chris Moon is reviewing the $215 iPoker Sunday Major. Ben Warrington does commentary on a live session across a variety of stakes. And I use a $215 four-handed WCOOP event to talk about post-game analysis and how to analyze your bluffing strategy. So no matter your stakes or your style, there's going to be something for you at tournamentpokeredge.com. Today's hand comes from Chris. It's from a $7 tournament on PokerStars. This must be one of the first hands of the tournament, which, by the way, is a six-handed tournament. Everyone still has stacks of roughly 1,500. The blinds are 10 and 20, and our hero is under the gun with 10-9 suited. Chris opens with a raise to 40, which is a minimum raise. The cutoff calls, the small blind calls, and the big blind folds. So we go three-handed to the flop with 140 in the pot. Our hero again holding 10-9 suited. And the flop is 8-8-7 with two spades, which gives our hero two overs and an open-ended straight draw, but no backdoor flush draw for him.
So what do you think of pre-flop? I think that opening under the gun at a six-handed table with 10-9 suited is usually uncontroversial. There's a question about the sizing. I understand why the minimum raise is so popular in tournaments, but in this case, we're 75 big blinds deep with no antes in the pot, and I would be inclined to make it like 50 or 55 for a lot of the same reasons that I'd be inclined to make more than a minimum raise in a cash game. Well, what do you think of that?
My biggest concern is that he's raising, that Chris raised the same amount here, regardless of, you know, like, I don't think he should be min-raising because he has 10-9 suited, but then making a bigger raise when he has pocket aces. Right. I think that's far more important than, you know, if, as long as he has a consistent raise size, that's, I think, the most important thing. In terms of whether that raise should be 40 or more than that, I mean, there's certainly a case for making it bigger, as you say. Like with deeper stacks, there's a reason to use larger sizes. I mean, I think part of it kind of depends on how Hero intends on approaching this table. I think, like, and this is not necessarily the best strategy for playing a $7 tournament, but if it is your intention to be raising a lot of hands, playing a lot of hands, and wanting to leave a lot of room for post-flop play without committing too much pre-flop when you generally have weaker ranges than your opponents, there is a case for using smaller raise sizing across the board. I don't really mind doing the min-raising here. It is actually possibly a strategy that I would adopt in a higher stakes six-handed tournament if I thought that the most of my table were kind of on the tightish, straightforward side, which again is not necessarily what I'd expect from a $7 MTT, but I can see this being a pre-flop raising strategy that I'd want to adopt at the right six-handed table.
I see. Would you also do that at a cash game?
Yes, for the same good reasons.
Okay, good.
But yeah, that makes sense. You're right that there really are not tournament-specific considerations in play here. Maybe a little.
Not big ones. Not big ones. Good. So 140 in the pot. Flop 8 of diamonds, 8 of spades, 7 of spades, and what happens next?
The small blind leads out for 120. I think that with the Hero having the two overs and open-ended straight draw, I think that folding is out of the question here. I mean, you'd really need a quite good read, I think, on this player before you would fold this hand, and I don't see how you could have that unless you had a lot of history with him like this early in a tournament. So you could maybe make a case for raising because you have a pretty good draw with kind of minimal showdown value, but I think there's a ton, like a 10 or a 9 is quite possibly good for our Hero on the turn as well. Yeah. So I think that there's not a huge need to raise right now. I would say that raising is better than folding, but I think that calling is the best thing to do, which is what our Hero does.
And also, like, a lot of the hands that you can represent by raising, you can also represent by calling and then betting the turn. Like raising is good largely if his range is 7 heavy or pocket 8s heavy or something, or pocket 8s, pocket 9s heavy, something like that. And I mean, I do think with this large bet sizing, 120 into 140, you are going to run up against a lot of opponents, especially in $7 tournaments that have a lot of medium strength hands here. So rather than raise immediately, I think there are playability advantages to just calling, first, if somebody has a good hand behind you. Second, if somebody has a not very good hand behind you and you hit a straight, that's also good. Like, you can, like, you're the straight draw sort of element of your hand benefits from calling in a lot of ways, and your hand has as much or maybe even more bluffability by calling. You're being in position against the sort of range that you would like to bluff against. Is as good as raising here or even better. So I really like a call.
Yeah, I think the bluffability point is a very good one, and it's something that it's not only a matter of flatting is probably how you would play a lot of your strongest hands, which I think is true, but it's also that I think when you're dealing with more straightforward opponents, which I would just assume that a lot of people in a $7 tournament are, I just think they're going to give up a lot of information if you give them the chance. And there's so many ways, like, because at this point, we don't have a real clear idea of what his hand is other than that he likes it and thinks it could be good. So, you know, he could have a flush draw, he could have a lower pair, he could have a 7, he could have a slightly higher pair than the board. There's even some chance he has an 8, although I would think people would be a little more inclined to check those, but I wouldn't at all be shocked to see an 8 here. Yeah. So, you know, other than thinking that this guy probably doesn't have a complete air ball, and sometimes you will even see people bet here with ace high, just thinking, like, that it might be good or that, I don't know. It's not. I've seen weirder. So we don't have a real clear idea of his range yet. We don't, among other things, like we know that we have a lot of equity against most of his range, which is why we don't want to fold. But we also don't really know which cards are going to be good or bad for him yet. And we don't even necessarily know which cards are good or bad for us. Like, we don't know for sure if a 9 is going to give us the best hand or not. So I think that having position on a player like this is going to just give you a lot of opportunities to outplay him on the next street, because he has to act before you do. And so you can tell, like, if he checks a spade, I would certainly bet at that point. If he makes a small bet on a spade, I might consider raising. If he makes a big bet on a spade, I would fold. So just like knowing that this player is probably going to give you a lot of information on the next street, and you have such a kind of versatile hand that's very dependent on what it turns out your opponent has in terms of how you want to play your hand, I think that's a pretty strong case as well for just like you can't use your position as well once you raise the flop. Like, the stacks are shallower, the hand might end on the flop, and also your opponent is far more likely to check the turn to you, which means that you're not going to get information from his action on the turn, because he's going to do it with a far more balanced range if you raise the flop.
I like that. What happens on the turn?
The turn is the Jack of Clubs, just about the best hand in the best card in the deck for Hero, I would say. Maybe a 6 is slightly better, but Hero makes his straight on the turn. The small blind checks, and our hero chooses... the cutoff folded on the flop, by the way. So we're now heads up to the turn. The small blind checks. The hero bets 220 into what is now a pot of 380. And the small blind calls. I might quibble a little bit. I think we could maybe get away with a slightly larger bet size here. I think a lot of people are going to have difficulty folding a pair at this point. And even a flush draw might get stubborn. I don't think the bet size is terrible. I might bet 260 instead of 220, but it's a pretty minor point.
Yeah, I like that, especially since depending on the player's sophistication, some of the hands he's leading could have a jack in them, and he could have a jack here that he'll be very much disinclined to fold, right. both for fundamental reasons and because nobody likes to run into top pair then fold it. I think as a basic matter. Oh, also, you're not going to have that many like pure floats here, so it's not clear that preserving the ability to bluff smaller with the bluffing part of your range is going to be all of that valuable. Like, I like having a uniformly larger bet size here, and 220 is not small, but I agree. I would prefer 250 or something like that.
The small blind calls the bet of 220, and I think it's worth pausing for a second to think about what information that gives us about small blind's range. So I was saying on the flop, the only thing I was really comfortable ruling out was that it was just like complete air, and even then, like, I thought there might be some chance of just like ace five or something random.
But sure, that happens.
So I'm definitely going to take the ace five offsuit out of his range once he checks and calls the turn. I don't really see that happening. I would say at this point, like, there's an outside chance he's slow playing a monster, but I think a lot of people, so for one thing, people tend to focus a lot more on flush draws than on straight draws. So, I mean, there's a bit of a case for checking and calling with an eight at this point, you know, just in case you hit a straight, but probably this player is going to be a lot more concerned. If he puts you on a draw on the flop, he's going to be a lot more concerned about those two spades than he is about the jack just getting there. Plus, 5-6 is still drawing, 9-6 is still drawing. There's a lot of reasons why a player might want to bet again if he took the lead on the flop with trips. So I think that checking the flop, like the flop check makes trips, certainly not ruling out entirely, but makes them a good deal less likely. I think that, you know, this might be a really trappy way of playing a full house. And I mean, people do like to trap when they have hands that big, but I think that he wouldn't have bet the flop. Like, if he were in a trapping mood with a full house, he probably wouldn't have taken the lead on the flop. So if he does have a full house, I would say the most likely way for that would be either pocket jacks or jack eight, where he had a more vulnerable hand on the flop, and then he improved to a pretty much unbeatable hand on the turn and decided to slow play at that point. But I think that's going to be quite unlikely as well. So I would think that his range for checking and calling here is mostly going to consist of either the kind of marginal one pair sort of hands that he doesn't want to give up on, whether it's pocket nines, a seven, maybe really stubborn with pocket sixes, like you say, Nate, maybe if he found a way to turn a jack. I think you can have a lot of those like one pair bluff catcher sorts of hands, and then I think draws, in particular spade draws, are still going to be in his range as well.
Yeah, and a non-trivial number of spade draws will also have a jack in them.
Good point.
Yeah.
The river brings the Ace of Spades, probably not the card Hero was hoping to see, given what we were just saying. There is now 820 in the pot. The final board is 8 of Diamonds, 8 of Spades, 7 of Spades, Jack of Clubs, Ace of Spades. Our Hero again holding 10-9 for a straight. And the small blind bets 680 into what is now an 820 pot. So, you know, based on the hand reading that we did on the turn, you know, my read at that point was that our villain likely had either a spade draw or a one pair hand with an outside chance of a full house. So it's really important to think here, although this might look like a good bluffing card, the point is that this card actually improves pretty much all of the hands the villain might consider bluffing with. In my experience, people tend not to turn hands that have some showdown value into a bluff. So I would think that if the villain had a jack, if he had pocket nines, he wouldn't be really inclined to try to turn that into a bluff. There's some question. I mean, at this point, pocket sixes really doesn't have much showdown value. So, I mean, there's some chance he would decide to turn that into a bluff, but I don't think you see that often. So usually if I'm going to call a bet just planning to pick off a bluff, I want to be able to put my opponent on some hands that really have zero showdown value, which in this case would have to be either, you know, 9-6 or 5-6 that missed a straight and is now trying to represent the flush. Hero does have one blocker to the 9-6 since he's holding 10-9. And, you know, it's also not a guarantee that someone is going to, like, I don't think he's necessarily going to bet all of his combinations of 5-6 or 9-6. Like, I don't necessarily assume that people are always going to bluff when they have that hand.
Or call preflop with it, for that matter.
Yeah, very good point.
From the small blind.
Very good point. So you know, where I'm going with this is that I don't think villain is bluffing. And I don't think Hero can beat any hand that the villain is going to be betting for value at this point. I don't see the villain doing this with just an 8. I think if he chose to play an 8 defensively on the turn, I don't see why he would now essentially bomb the river. I mean, he's betting over half of his stack. He's betting a very large percentage of the pot. You know, if this is a bet of 200 on the river, I might start to think an 8 makes a little more sense, where he's just making a blocking bet. This does not feel like a blocking bet. This feels to me like a very polarized bet, where villain, you know, is either very confident in having the best hand or very confident in not having the best hand. And I just don't think there's any reason why he would bet with the hands that... like, I don't see a lot of those latter candidates for the latter category hands that are, like, clearly not good. I don't think he has a lot of those in his range, and I don't think that Hero can beat any of the hands that villain is going to be very confident in. I don't see villain doing this for value with a hand worse than a straight.
I agree, and I would be inclined to fold this hand. You know, the bet sizing in particular is quite telling to me. There's a small worry about folding your whole range here, but I do think I would play some flush draws like this. The big problem is that the spade that came on the river was the ace, and that really cuts out a lot of the spade draws that I could have having played this way. I would, in fact, call instead of raise with many of my flush draws on the flop, I think, for a lot of the reasons that we were talking about in terms of bluffability and playability and all that, for a lot of the same reasons we called with our straight draw on the flop. So I think there's probably a slightly exploitive element to this fold, but that's okay, I think. And it's probably less exploitive than a lot of people think it is.
Yeah, I mean, the main way that the villain would exploit this would be by taking the bottom of his range and always bluffing with it. Which would mean, you know, if he has hands like 5-6 and 9-6 in his range, he would have to always bluff with those, which in my experience a lot of smaller stakes players are not going to do.
Yeah.
He would also probably need to take some hands that do have some showdown value, like, I mean, I don't think he should even be calling the turn with pocket sixes, so let's take a somewhat stronger hand than that. You know, let's say that he did check and call on the turn with, 7-6.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he could consider turning that into a bluff at this point and betting to try to get it off of a straight. Like, basically, because the big problem here for villain is that the bottom of his range is pretty strong, having taken the line that he's taken. And so in order for him to have bluffing candidates, he has to bluff with some hands that would seem like they had some showdown value to them. And this, again, is something that I think only very sophisticated players tend to do, like to recognize when the bottom of their range is actually a hand that that might seem more like a bluff catcher than a bluffing candidate. And I don't think a lot of players in a $7 tournament are really going to recognize that and take advantage of it, which is why you can exploit them by folding seemingly strong hands that are still only bluff catchers.
I agree. Can I forestall a different objection, which is that What if this person just has no idea what relative hand values are and he's doing this with an 8? And the problem is that this kind of opponent would not play up to the river with a strong hand. Like, either he would have checked the flop or he would have just bombed it all the way. Like, it's just very unusual that somebody who's not paying attention to the flush draw, who's not paying attention to the straight draw, who's just an absolute hand strength kind of player, and really quite situationally unaware. It's just, this is a very unlikely line for that kind of player to take. So once in a great while, you'll see somebody, I have an ace or something, or, maybe he had ace queen and he played this way. This has been known to happen, but I think that's not very common, and I wouldn't worry about folding this hand to that guy.
I think anytime you see this kind of huge swing in behavior where he goes from very aggressive on the flop to very passive on the turn to very aggressive again on the river, that usually indicates an actual swing in hand strength. And not just an actual swing in his perception of his hand strength. So, what is it that causes him to think that he has a hand worth betting on the flop, but then not a hand worth betting on the turn, but then a hand worth betting again on the river? I just think, because as you say, if he's just overvaluing an 8, then we would expect that he would bomb the turn, or if he was being trappy with an 8, we would expect that he would check call the flop and the turn. And there's really no way to explain that disparity of, why would he choose to play an 8 aggressively on the flop but then defensively on the turn, and then do another 180 and play it aggressively again on the river. I think that's the thing that really needs to be explained.
Agreed.
So very nice hand, Chris. And Chris did fold, which we don't know what the villain actually had, but I think this is a very good fold and one that does require a bit of discipline. And I imagine that part of the reason Chris asked for our input on this hand is that he was having a little bit of doubt about this. So let me remove all nagging doubt from your mind, Chris. This is definitely a good fold. I can't promise you what your villain had, but I'm quite sure that you played your hand well.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go talk to the Alberta folks, huh?
We have Professor Michael Bowling, who is the head of the computer. Is it the computer research group at the University of Alberta?
The computer poker research group.
The computer poker, of course. The computer poker research group at the University of Alberta. And I'm sorry, Michael, I'm blanking on your last name.
Johansson.
Yes. And we have Michael Johansson, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Can you also maybe start just by telling us a bit about what the Computer Poker Research Group is?
Sure. The Computer Poker Research Group is a research group that's actually been around for a while. It's been about 15 years. The goals of the group are actually to explore artificial intelligence, to explore techniques for building computers to make decisions in intelligent ways for complex problems. And while that's primarily our goal, we use poker as a particular test case for problems that humans do very well on, for which our computer systems are not particularly suited. So, for example, it is well known now that we have programs that can beat top players at the game of chess, which has a particular form where it's a perfect information game. The players know every piece of information they need to know about the state of the game when making their decisions. And those techniques don't carry over very well to the space of poker. And so how can we develop new techniques to improve our AI systems so that they can handle the complexities that for which poker is a perfect example of? And so while we do study the game of poker, our primary goals are around advancing general artificial intelligence techniques, but we test them in the space of poker.
So poker just makes from your perspective, poker is just a particularly good test case. You don't have an intrinsic interest in poker.
I mean, obviously, it's a fun game to look at. And I think the fact that there are many players and it's a popular game has an appeal that, for one, we can actually do very easily matches against humans and use that as a benchmark. If we were playing some made-up game or an obscure game, we wouldn't have that as a benchmark. And so this has been very exciting. So in the past, we've ran man-machine matches where we've played our programs, and we are, in fact, doing it now, where we're playing our programs against top human players. And this gives a certain excitement to it that we're really making advances that we can measure. So, there are definitely advantages of poker. That means it's not just any other game. But our goals aren't to produce the world's best poker-playing programs. Our goals are those techniques are going to be applicable outside the space of poker.
So, go ahead, Nate.
Is there anything that you can say in general about what poker has taught you about artificial intelligence generally? Are there sort of like bumper sticker conclusions that you have, like, genetic algorithms are less useful than we thought they would be, or once you get into messy, imperfect information games, this kind of algorithm works much better?
Yeah, I think what poker has presented is a number of challenges to standard algorithms. So what's there's a couple of dominant approaches in perfect information games. The one sort of standard is minimax search or alpha beta search, is a particular optimization to it. That technique just simply doesn't apply. You can try to look at ways that you could search the space of poker, but one of the main problems is in minimax search, you know exactly what state you're in, and you're searching the possible outcomes that can come from that state. But in poker, you don't even know what state you're in because you don't know the other player's cards. And so the techniques that are common in chess and that were successful in checkers just don't apply. Another common technique is Monte Carlo tree search, which has been popularized in the game of Go and has made leaps and bounds in the game of Go. But it is exactly the same thing again, where you don't know what state you're in. And so the technique, people have tried to apply the technique to imperfect information games. Poker is actually an example where if you did it, you would actually immediately discover that it doesn't work. It tends to, its ideal would be to produce event essentially pure strategies, that it's going to deterministically in this situation say, I'm going to raise all the time, which makes her a very predictable poker player and is easily defeated. I think one of the things that poker obviously shows you that any human would of course know is that you don't want to be predictable in your play. That's exactly what you don't want to do. And many of the AI techniques we have are all about being predictable in their play because they've never had to worry about it before.
When you say many of the AI techniques we have, you mean techniques that were successful in solving other games like you were just talking about?
Exactly.
And poker is unique, well, for one, because of the significant element of having imperfect information. And then I guess also because it matters how much you win by. Right? It's not just like, you know, chess, you either win or you lose. In poker, you want to win by as much as possible.
Yeah, that's right. Like you mentioned, in one of the defining things about poker, right, is that you're not trying to just, you know, eke out a win against your opponent. You're really trying to maximally, you know, take all the money you can from them. This leads to a whole new area of research about opponent modeling techniques and adaptation techniques to try to discover what your opponent's doing wrong and really use that information to win more. And that's a thing that was never important in checkers or chess or Go or these other games.
In fact, often there was work I know of, a few papers on trying to do opponent modeling in the game of chess, because it does come about. You could be in a position where, as far as you're concerned, like you're in a draw position. That if they play optimally and you play optimally, that you think the game's going to end in a draw. But it doesn't mean that all drawing moves from here on out are all the same. You might prefer ones that put your opponent in a position where they're likely to make a mistake, and suddenly the game might flip to a win. And so if you could model where they make their mistakes, there's an advantage there. But what people found in the game of chess is that spending time, computation time, to use your model and learn your model would be better off spent just simply getting better estimates of what a generally strong move is. And if I could just search deeper, that would almost always be better than to be smarter about building a model of your search. There's a question in poker, and I don't know that we have the answer to it yet, about whether that's still true. If you had a choice of how to use your computation, would you rather use it to get a better approximation of just generally good poker play that can't be exploited by a smart player, or would you rather be modeling? But I do think poker presents a slight dichotomy. We do most of our computation in poker before we sit down at the table. There's massive computations behind our computer programs. It takes months of computation on clusters of machines with hundreds of CPUs. And that actually happens before it sits down to play a single hand. As a result, while it's playing, it actually has time to think about whether there's options for doing opponent modeling. Because at that moment, any computation it does now is dwarfed by the massive computation that's already happened. So we can actually use that time to think about how to do opponent modeling. And so there is this open door for in poker that's more so than in the other games for an opportunity to do modeling. And it's the reason it's important is for the reason you gave, which is you want to take more money from somebody rather than just being a winner.
And computational time, that's like the big limiting factor on being able to solve. I mean, at least heads up poker is in theory solvable, and the barrier is just that there's not nearly enough computational power to actually do it. So if I understand correctly, your task is trying to find ways of I guess shortcuts, essentially ways of virtual or almost solving the game with using, you know, much less computational power than would be required to solve it perfectly.
Yeah, you're right. For two-player games, right, there is at least one of these, you know, perfect Nash equilibrium strategies that's guaranteed to not lose against anyone else. And that's what most of the strong computer poker programs try to do, is to try to approximate one of those Nash equilibrium strategies. We have, there's kind of two constraints that make that hard. The one is computation time, and the other one is just memory. For example, if you're playing, like, the simplest, you know, human scale game, right? If we're talking about heads up limit Texas Hold'em, if you were to use one of the state of the art algorithms for solving that game, it would take 523 terabytes of RAM to try to compute a strategy. And this is just a huge amount. So it's both the time and the memory.
So what are some of the strategies that you've used to reduce, would you call it the game space? Am I using that term correctly?
Sure. Yep, game space, game size. What most of the strong programs do, right, because we don't have enough time or memory to exactly compute one of the optimal strategies, is we do what's called an abstraction step. So we take the full game that we're trying to play, and we find some way to reduce it down to a small but strategically similar fake game, like a made-up game, which we call an abstract game. So once you've made a small game that you can use your AI technique to make a perfect strategy for the small game, and then use that strategy to play the real game again. Maybe as an example of what one of these fake games would be, if you can imagine, for example, if we change the game so that all the cases where you had either a pair of aces or a pair of kings, maybe you merge those two together, and you say you have a strong pair. You don't know whether it's aces or kings, but you know it's one of those two, right? Every time you do one of these steps where you merge two decisions together, it makes the game smaller and simpler. There's a little bit of a loss to it, because maybe sometimes it's really important to know whether you have the aces or the kings. So that means the strategy you get at the end isn't perfect, but if you do a good job about, you know, how you shrink things down, it might still be good enough.
So one obvious way that humans do this is by characterizing a flop according to its texture, and then having a rough idea of how they proceed with different types of hands on different textures of flops. Is that in the same ballpark as this process you're describing?
Yep, absolutely. We usually think about this as two steps where there's a public information, you know, like you said, board texture. That's one way that we can reduce the game size. And then the other way is by talking about private cards, right? Maybe two private hands are very similar under a certain board. There's actually a third one as well. As soon as we get into no-limit games, the number of possible betting actions that you have is huge. And so we have to do some abstraction there. So instead of being able to bet, you know, one chip, two chips, three chips, we shrink it down to a smaller number, you know, maybe pot size, half pot, two pot, this kind of thing.
And then if somebody makes a, you know, three-quarter pot bet, and we didn't exactly have that in our space, then we have to figure out that's strategically close to what size bet do we actually understand. And so we're constantly having to, we call this the translation step, we have to translate the real game into our fake game to say what decision point in our fake game is strategically closest to the real game.
It's interesting. We talked about this exact process with Johannes, who works on the Poker Snowy project, and he said that choosing sets of bet sizes was difficult, and that he had some reasons for doing what he did, but the team was going to experiment with other bet sizes, and he wasn't that confident that they had chosen really good ones. Or maybe I'm slightly misremembering what he said. How did you go about choosing your set of bet sizes for the no limit game, and are you confident that you chose that well?
Yeah, there's actually two challenges that are kind of tied together, right? And the one problem is, what bet sizes do you want your program to be able to make, right? So you want to make sure that your program has, you know, bet sizes that are going to be useful, right? If it only has pot size bets and that's it, then it is losing some value at spots where it should be making half pot bets or two pot bets, this kind of thing. So choosing your own bet sizes is one problem that you need to solve. The second one, though, that's a lot more dangerous in practice is trying to guess what bet sizes your opponents might make. Because every time your opponent makes a bet that's not one of the ones you anticipated, you have to figure out which of your other bets is closest to try to, you know, simulate what you think they were trying to do. So we handle these two sides in very different ways. For the what I'm going to call the defensive side, trying to interpret what my opponent's bets mean, we usually use a fairly large number of bets spread all throughout the space to make sure that there's always something nearby. For choosing our own bet sizes, that's a little bit more interesting. We've done some work in the past looking at the bet sizes humans like to use. We have a couple of algorithms that let us train the program to discover its own bet sizes that it wants to use in certain spots.
Have you discovered anything about, you know, which bet sizes are more or less useful? I mean, I'd be curious to know, for instance, how many bet sizes you found useful to have, you know, that are larger than pot. You know, do you frequently find that to be important to bet more than the size of the pot and to be able to bet two versus three versus four times the size of the pot?
I think the ones we see most commonly actually used by the program are probably the ones you'd expect, right? You know, half pot, maybe one and a half, this type of thing. We usually have a number of larger bet sizes that the bot can make that it quickly learns not to, right? So, you know, a 10 pot, a 12 pot bet, these are in there almost defensively in case the opponent does it, but the bot doesn't actually make them. Maybe the one surprising one is last year we started playing with min bets for our bot. We actually added in the min bets as an aggressive action to use against other programs, because min bets are often difficult for other programs to defend against.
Let me interrupt for a second to say that again, remember, there's the two reasons for to have a bet in your abstraction. There's the I need to interpret it because the other opponent might make a bet like this, and then I might want to make it myself. And one reason to have min bets, and I think the reason we talked about it, was we knew this was a hole in our program, that if you made a min bet against us, we would translate it to our smallest possible bet because we have no other choice but to do that. And so we would translate it to maybe half pot if that was our smallest bet. And so you could have this enormous pot, make a min bet at us, and we would think that you were betting a half pot. We didn't want to commit that, and we would fold. And so we knew there was this egregious error in our programs. And so if we could train our program to recognize min bets, that could stop the error. But of course, we also know we're playing against other programs. We know that it's hard to put in a min bet. It's very computationally costly to put in a min bet. So we also want to make them because we know that other programs won't be able to translate them.
The surprising thing that we found was that the program actually did choose to make min bets.
When it knew it could translate them.
Yeah, even when it knew it was not tricking the opponent, that the opponent would understand what a min bet meant, the program, in its, you know, optimal Nash equilibrium strategy, did learn and choose to make min bets. This was something that the human testers that we talk to tell us is very unusual and probably a mistake, but the bot chooses to make it.
And in its abstract game, we know it's optimal. We know that this made-up game that we made, min bets are the right. It's a made-up no-limit game, and min bets are the right thing to do. So I don't know. There's a little bit of evidence, but I'm not going to defend this because I'm not an expert poker player. But there's a little bit of evidence that maybe common wisdom about just how fishy min bets are. Maybe that's not true. This wouldn't be the first time. We did see this when we were building limit programs, that top players were very surprised at how wide of a range we would hold in various situations. We would call down with queen high in a heads-up limit game and thought this was just absolutely terrible. And I think now over time, that's generally perceived as, no, that's like, it's a heads-up limit game. Queen high is actually pretty strong.
That's fascinating. I remember reading The Mathematics of Poker, and at least one juncture and possibly more, you get to a point where analytically you want to bet less than the minimum bet allowed by the game, like like somebody would bet $10 and And if it were allowed, the best move would be to raise to like $16, but that's not allowed. So you raised to 20 instead. I'm sure you're familiar with all of this stuff. So first, when you say min bet, does that include things like min raises, or is it actually like betting one big blind into a 40 big blind pot? And second, do those results from Mathematics of Poker, which I guess are just other toy games than the probably more sophisticated toy games that you guys have, do those give you more confidence that min betting might be an underused strategy?
Mike and I are shrugging. So as to your first question, are you talking about min bets and min raises? So one of the problems with interpreting min bets is that you have the entire space of how the betting could go out. And after someone makes a min bet or even a min raise, basically it doesn't change. You've now duplicated the entire space, now sits under the min raise, because basically the betting could follow with the same number of sequence of bets following after that. So every time you consider a possible min bet, it's almost like you're doubling the size of the game. So we're careful about how many we add in and where we add them in. So we're not considering, like, for example, we don't consider a min raise after just arbitrary sequence of betting coming before that. So we have to be somewhat careful on how we add these bets. As far as recognizing that, the Mathematics of Poker sees similar-like things, I don't know. We tend not to, as a group, we have tended not to try to debate too much what our bots choose to do. There's a couple of reasons that's been true. One is because you miss the opportunity for the bot to prove the rest of the world wrong. Right. If every time it's making something unusual, your initial reaction is that's probably wrong. So our initial reaction at this point, and it's probably back from having experience of doing this, is that if the top players tell us our bot is wrong about something, we still listen, because there might be opportunities where we can understand how that could have happened because of the abstraction. But often I'm more willing to say, no, I don't know, I'm willing to go with the bot on this one and wait for the future to prove who's right.
Oh, sure. That's very reasonable. I just thought it was interesting that one thing that really struck me when I was reading the only long book I've ever read about game theory and poker, there were also these situations where unexpectedly small bet sizing turned out to be a really good idea. And okay, it's interesting that this premier computer poker research group was in a different way finding the same thing.
Right. I mean, our problem to some degree right now, and our discussions are around, even if this is right, even if we're absolutely justified in that we should be making these min bets, it's perceived very weakly. And what I want to do is really be able to demonstrate that we have some of the top programs in the world, and eventually I want to take on the best players at, say, Heads Up No Limit. If they're going to perceive that weakness, they might not be really willing to play against us, because they might think it's a waste of their time. Like, obviously, if we're playing for money, they'd be happy to see that perceived weakness. That wouldn't be a waste of their time. But then I need to back up our bot with the piles of cash that, as a research group in a public institution, we don't have. So for example, when we did the limit man machine matches, we were thankful that we had very benevolent participants who were good players who were willing to play against our bot for very, very small amounts of money. That was, only really just trying to recognize that their time is valuable.
Have there been other, you mentioned the min betting, you mentioned calling down extremely light in limit hold'em. Are there any other examples you can give of cases where you discovered something that seems to be at odds with received wisdom, as you know it in the poker world?
You want me to try?
Yeah, you go ahead.
So one of the problems, so we know a few of these examples. I'll give one more. This is pretty much the only other one I know. But I fear every time I talk about this, I just admit just how poker ignorant I am. And your audience will laugh at just how obtuse we are when it comes to poker. But I think one of the other examples, and we know this in the heads up limit, limping in the small blind, particularly in 2007, 2008, was considered a disastrous. Like that was something you just don't do. Arbot would happily do it. And then, in fact, we were even questioning it. There was times where, like, it was even questionable whether our bot should do it. I think in some of the instances of our bot, we actually didn't have it do it. I remember one of the top bot makers actually took it out even as an option. He built a strategy where limping wasn't even an option, with the idea being the game's now, this abstract toy games is much smaller, and he could solve it a bigger game because of that. I think now all of the strong programs limp. I think there isn't any doubt that limping is part of an optimal strategy.
Yeah, I think it's still part of our best strategies for sure.
So maybe I should say there isn't any doubt. Until the game is solved, we're not going to know whether it's possible to be part of an optimal strategy. But I think the evidence points to it probably is. But I think even the computer poker world has gone back and forth a little bit on that. But I suspect the reason they have is because the poker players were so adamant that this is probably the wrong thing to do.
Now, I know you've played a bit. You mentioned these man-machine competitions where you're playing against some human experts. For the most part, the impression I got from kind of poking around your site is that mostly you're competing in this thing called the Annual Computer Poker Competition, which I guess, a collection of folks such as yourself from universities and a few hobbyists as well who get together and put up their computer AIs against each other each year.
That summarizes pretty well, yep.
Can you maybe explain like what exactly, how exactly are those competitions structured? Like how do you measure who's the winner, how many players compete in a competition, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so we started having the annual computer poker competition in 2006, and it's run every year since then. Right now we're playing three different types of poker. We play heads-up limit, heads-up no limit with 200 chip blinds, or sorry, 200 chip stacks, and three-player limit. For every one of those three events, we have two different ways of picking a winner. There's always what we call the instant runoff competition. Instant runoff is about trying to not lose to anyone. It's about trying to be like the most robust strategy that can go up against any of the other opponents and not lose. There's also the other competition, which is called the bankroll competition. In bankroll, we're trying to maximize the amount of money you make against the field, even if that means you lose against some of the stronger opponents. If you're able to win a lot more against the weaker ones, then you can win the bankroll competition.
So the basic premise of how it's run is that every single possible pairing of bots has matches done against it. The matches are, they vary from competition. I think they're typically 3,000 hands long. A match will run. After a match is over, the bots are reset, as in their memories are wiped so that they couldn't possibly carry over any knowledge. So if you want to learn something, you're going to have to learn it in that 3,000 hands. And then we clear all the bots' memory and we repeat it again. And one of the tricks we'll use is duplicate, where that repetition will actually repeat the exact same cards, but the bots will be flipped in which side they get dealt. And so we can now take the sum of those two scores over the two matches as a better estimate of their likely winning. And then we'll repeat that whole process again for those same two bots over and over again, maybe 50 times. So we might get about 150,000 duplicate, so this is where we've swapped the sides of the cards, matches, against every pairing of programs.
Can I ask a really silly question at this point? Why 150,000? Why not like 2 million? Which I think could be done in seconds, if I understand right. Or does it not make that much of a difference?
Two reasons. One is you have to remember that we might have 10 entries. If we have 10 entries, there's 90 different pairings that we have to go up against.
Okay.
So that 150,000 hands now translates to 15 million hands are going to be run for the competition.
Okay.
So if we have millions of hands per match, then now it's 90 million hands needed to be run for the competition. So one is just how many hands. But the second thing is, no, they don't play, not all programs play instant. So okay. Our older programs, as of a few years ago, they were pretty much instant. They had tables that they would just simply query as we talked about before, that you know they get the real game state that you're in. You can translate it into the abstract game state, look it up into a table. It tells you that you should raise with this probability, call with this probability, fold with this probability, flip some random number generators, and off you go. And you could easily blaze through a million hands in minutes.
You'll have to excuse me. I do bioinformatics, so anything until we start talking about billions sounds very, very small to me. So that's just my own bias.
For the more recent programs, I think, what's the limit? 7 seconds per hand?
7 seconds per hand.
Yeah, that's what entries in the competition get. That's what they're allowed. And some of the entries in the competition, including some of ours from last year, actually use that 7 seconds a hand. And they're using that time to do things like opponent modeling, right? You know, trying to learn about the opponent, figure out what it should do in response. So as soon as you're talking 7 seconds per hand, now it gets really expensive to try to do 2 million hands of poker.
So given our this technique of, say, using duplicate, among other things, we actually, so all of our results all have significance measures attached to them, and so we can say just how statistically significant they are. And so generally our statistical significance numbers between any pairing of bots will get down to 5-ish millibets, which is our unit of choice in our field. A millibet is a thousandth of a big blind. So 750 millibets is what Always Fold would lose every hand. A good player might expect to win about 50 millibets a hand. And so we're trying to get our numbers down to where we can separate players by around 5. Now, that doesn't mean that we can always. Sometimes we'll have programs that we actually don't distinguish. Some of the top players in Limit now are pretty much indistinguishable downwards at the 1 or 2 millibet level. There's money behind all of this. You know, anytime you run computation, we actually run the competition now on Amazon Cloud. So you can actually attach a dollar figure to what would it mean if we ran twice as many or 10 times as many hands.
that makes a lot of sense.
So we do stop at some point. I mean, our goal is to make sure that we're making statistically significant judgments, because, you know, this is after all a research effort, and we want to make sure we're not just, you know, declaring some random person the winner because they got lucky. But we're only going to do what we need to try to satisfy that, since we would rather spend our money on research advancement rather than running more competitions.
That makes sense. It must have been nice then to wake up last month and find that AWS had cut its prices. Yes?
Yes.
I imagine that helped you guys out.
What's the reason? It sounds like all these competitions are in Hold'em, which, I mean, I can assume this has to do with the fact that it's a relatively simple game compared to, you know, 7-card stud, where there are more betting rounds, or Omaha, where there are more hidden cards. I guess commonly played poker variant I can think of that might be simpler would be 5-card stud with, I guess, an equivalent number of betting rounds and less hidden information. Is it just because Hold'em is such a popular game that you've chosen to focus on that?
This is probably a result of 2006. It was the popular game. Mm. I will say it's not, so if you were to say, let me take Omaha as an example. I think the translation to Omaha would not be remarkable in any way. The complexity of Omaha, as you point out, is in the private cards. I think the same types of abstraction techniques would work extremely well there. I suspect we could make just as strong of programs in Omaha as we could make in Texas Hold'em. I also generally suspect that humans are worse at Omaha than Texas Hold'em, so we would actually just be better humans there.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true.
Have you considered opening up a consultancy? Like, I imagine there would be a real market for Omaha advice from your bot.
No comment.
So the bit about how easily this could be translated to Omaha reminds me of something I wanted to come back and ask you about, which is you talked earlier on about one of the ways that you simplify the game was by trying to find ways of treating similar hands as though they were exactly the same hand. And from reading some of your papers, the impression I get is that you call these buckets.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, can you explain a bit about how it is that you decide? I mean, the connection between aces and kings preflop is a pretty clear one. But it seems like in some cases it's, you know, a hand that is very weak in terms of its, you know, it might just be six high, but because it has a flush draw, it's actually a better hand than eight high without some sort of draw. So can you say a little bit about how hands that are more complicated than just kings and aces, you know, how you decide which bucket to put those in and how you decide how many buckets you're going to use and that sort of thing?
Yeah. I'm going to let Mike answer that, but let me interrupt for 1 second and just say, we never really clarified. We say we make these toy games, but I want to clarify that toy games don't look anything like, say, the mathematics of poker toy games, because we are going to solve them with a computer and not by hand. And so, for example, Heads Up, Limit Texas Hold'em, the sort of smallest variant of a game that humans play, there are approximately 100 million decision points in that game. So it's 10 to the 14th number of decision points in that game. We abstract that down to, say, a million decision points in the game. Like, we make a game that's 100 times smaller, but it's still enormous. And so when Mike talks about bucketing here, we are talking about, like, that example of aces and kings. We don't even do that. We treat every preflop hand separate because we have a lot of buckets to actually work with. We just don't have as many as the full game actually has.
Yeah, and in fact, in games like Heads Up Limit, we're even treating every possible flop combination of board cards and private cards independently too. And I think even on the turn, we're going that way now. So yeah, the type of abstraction that we do to simplify the cards is very, very fine-grained. The way that we actually decide how to do it, this is one of the big engineering efforts. Really what we do is we try to find, you know, what are useful statistics that we know about these hands so we can decide what hands are most similar. One of the classic ways to do it is just to think about equity, right? So if we're on the turn, I have a hand, my opponent has a hand, we can think about all the possible river cards that get dealt, what's my probability of winning against him over all these possible rivers? And that gives me a strength, a probability of winning, and then I can merge hands together if they have similar strength. Some of the more recent work that helps us to pick out flush draws and straight draws, right, these high potential hands or low potential hands, is to think not just about the expected probability of winning after rolling out all the river cards, but the whole shape of the histogram for how lucky can I get when the river card hits, and try to merge together hands that have similar histogram shapes, race that can get lucky or get unlucky in similar ways.
Which would mean, like, recognizing that a hand, like, even if two hands would have the same expected value after seeing the river, you would value more highly a hand whose value is very clearly defined, where it's either an extremely strong hand or an extremely weak hand on the river, as opposed to one that is not that clear?
Right. Yeah, it's not even so much a measure of valuing it more highly if it has this high potential. It's that that's just a very different type of hand. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the river, we might be making a million different buckets of, you know, a million different groupings of hands. And we're going to group them together if they have the same kind of histogram shapes, right? So it's not that we give higher value to hands that can get lucky. It's that all the hands with high potential go in one bucket, all the made hands with no potential go in another, all the ones with low potential go in another, and so on.
But much more fine-grained than that.
Right.
Yeah, except with a million different options. And the million hands aren't chosen by people. We use algorithms that group together hands automatically if they have these similar features.
I mean, one of the more recent features that we've been using to group them, again, automatically group them together, is how different, if you think about different kinds of hand someone might hold preflop, then what's your strength against each of these preflop set of hands? Like, here's the bottom sort of cluster of hands, and what's your strength against that? And you might actually have, again, very different shapes of those curves as you look at different sets of hands you might be competing against. Mm-hmm. And just any more, you know, every one of these statistics is yet another way that you could differentiate things. And so that all of these sort of different features get thrown into this algorithm whose job is to cluster them by similar features. And so that creates our buckets by, you know, all of these guys are really, really close according to the features you gave me, and these guys are also close according to the features you gave me, and so we try to create these buckets based on that.
I imagine that what I would call a blocker, meaning that if I have the ace of clubs in my hand and there are two clubs on the board, I know that my opponent, you know, cannot make an ace high flush. I guess that comes up at least implicitly anytime you're calculating the equity of a hand, because you know your opponent will never have the ace high flush in his in his range. But is that something that you take into account explicitly at any point? Like, I mean, are your programs, I guess, trained to recognize the value of a card like that?
Yeah, we started looking at blockers about a year ago, right? Because that's, you know, like strength and like potential, it's just another feature you can use to separate strategically different hands. I think the programs that we used in the competition last year did not do anything special for blockers, right? They weren't explicitly part of the feature it was looking for. That's something we're looking at adding in now.
When you, I guess, are devising a strategy, is your programs, are they coming out with, like, just deciding I'm going to check, or is it deciding something more sophisticated, like I'm going to check and then raise if he bets this certain amount? I mean, is that a decision that's made before checking, or is that you check and then once he raises, you reevaluate, then once your opponent bets, you reevaluate the situation and decide whether to raise?
So our programs learn to play by playing poker against themselves, right? So the way it works is they start off playing uniform random at every possible decision and treats every betting sequence independently. We usually don't do abstractions that merge together different betting sequences. Mm. So the program starts off playing uniform random. It plays against itself for about 100,000 games a second. It does this for, you know, weeks or months until it has a couple hundred billion hands behind it. And as it plays, you know, the more games it plays against itself, the better and better it gets. And it converges towards a Nash equilibrium, you know, in the limit as it plays enough games. So to get back to your question about does it decide before checking how it's going to respond, it doesn't really. It's already decided at every possible decision point in the game how it's going to play, and it decides that based on all these games it's played against itself. Mm-hmm. So when it actually sits down to play, it'll make a move and then wait for the opponent to respond and then see, you know, what it should have done based on the games it's played against itself in the past. So it's not so much searching ahead, like it already knows its strategy.
That's right. Cause you said that you do the computation in advance, right? And essentially it has a strategy that's already on a disk and it's just playing off of a predefined strategy.
So yep. It very well could look up, what would I do? I'm going to check here. And what am I going to do if you bet at me? But there'd be no reason to know that, because I might as well. I know that my strategy tells me to check here, so I'm going to check here. I'll wait to see what you do, and then I'll look up what, you know, I'm supposed to respond to that. Mm. And so it's all written down, so it does kind of implicitly know in advance how it's going to respond to everything. But the program itself is just simply querying in these large tables how to respond in any given situation.
What are the things that you all are looking to add to your programs to make them better at this point, you know, that they're not doing already, or what are kind of like the frontiers for you to keep improving?
I think opponent modeling, it's a funny thing in the sense that this is probably one of our biggest challenges. And it's one of the things we worked on. I mean, it's always been in our mind every bit of research we've done. I would say at any given moment in time, it's been probably half of our research program. But if you look at our research papers, it's not half of our research papers. And if you look at our success in competition, it's not even half of our success in competition, which just goes to show that the opponent modeling problem is really, really hard. So I get to continually say that's one of our you know, future work pieces is how do we do it, and how do we do it better. And I'll say a little bit about why it's hard, but of course any poker player would know this too. You know, you see such a tiny number of hands of real play against anybody that you need to draw inferences from. And statistically speaking, you can't, you know, you really have to generalize aggressively. Like, you can't just say, I saw in this one particular instance they responded to the check raise that way. If you just believe that it only applies to that instance and you can't generalize it to other instances that are similar to infer how they would respond in those, then you're gaining nothing. It would take forever for you to to build a complete model. The second challenge is that you don't get to see their cards all the time. So in actuality, you know, they might have folded in the situation, and you don't really know why they folded. You don't know if they folded because, you know, you made a big enough bet and they laid down a pretty good hand and they respected your bet, or they folded because they had garbage and they bluffed to get to this point. Like, you just have no idea. And so how do you deal with that on any given moment? You don't really seeing all the information to draw the proper inference from it. So what we mostly have in the space of opponent modeling is a whole slew of challenges that we don't know. We made a little bit of progress, but there's still a lot more to be done. I think the other major area I would say that's really far out there is multiplayer. So we call multiplayer when it's more than two. Two-player games, being that it's a zero-sum two-player game, we have very, very strong theory about like the existence of a mini-match optimal solution exists, and it's also a Nash equilibrium. This has really important properties. For one, it means that if I play according to a Nash equilibrium strategy, I'm guaranteed not to lose. On expectation, I might lose money over the short term, but I'm guaranteed not to lose an expectation. And also, if you're playing a Nash equilibrium, it doesn't matter. We don't have to agree on which one we're playing. Every pair of Nash equilibrium strategies is also a Nash equilibrium. So I don't really have to worry about anything that comes from like, are we matching in the right strategies? Hmm. If you go to a three-player game, all that theory goes away. And in fact, instead, it's replaced by lots of, you know, painful results. One of my favorite examples is we were playing around in a very tiny toy game. And by these toy games, I really mean like a really toy game. Like, it's got four cards, and one is dealt to each player. And it's just this little three-player poker game. And we computed a Nash equilibrium of this game. So it's a strategy for which no player can switch their strategy without the other players also switching and get any more money on expectations. So everyone, in some sense, given the other player's fixed strategies, are playing optimally. So we took that strategy, and then we took one of the players and we switched that player to always raise. This should be a really bad poker strategy. Now we know that switching them to always raise can't help them. Like, it's not going to give them any more money because they were playing Nash equilibrium. They couldn't possibly switch to anything and make more money. And it turns out they didn't. They lost just a tiny, tiny bit because they switched to always raise. But they didn't lose that much, in fact. But the result of that was the person on their left won a bunch more money, and the person on their right lost a bunch of money. And so here, one player makes what I'll call a mistake, plays a bad strategy, and the person who's punished isn't the person who made the mistake. It's the other another person sitting at the table. This can't happen in a two-player game. If someone makes a mistake, the other person must make money from it. So this very idea of a Nash equilibrium, which is what a lot of what our work has been based on when it comes to the game theoretic side of things, is problematic. It's not even clear we want one, because if I played my part of a Nash equilibrium and the person on my left plays always raise, I could lose a lot of money. And so it's not clear we want one, but then what do we put in this place? What do we want our computers to compute, and how should we react in these situations? We don't really have any formal answers to that question. We have a three-player game in the computer poker competition as a way to start to explore this. Our group has been really successful in that competition. I don't think we've lost a match in 3 years. And at the same time, I can with certainty say I have no idea what we're doing in that competition.
So I remember Ray Z once posted something online that said basically that he enforced some of the sportsman-like norms of the game by telling people that if they did something, he would play in such a way that it would be impossible for them to win. And tacitly, it also seemed like he could do that without giving up too much. And at the time, I thought that was somewhat implausible, or maybe only possible like in the really juicy games of 10 years ago. But now, after what you've just said, I'm starting to think that boy, maybe there really are these small strategic adjustments that can like really screw over somebody who's being mean. Do you have any sense? Have your instincts been strengthened for how possible that sort of thing might be at Hold'em?
I don't know at scale. I can only go back to little examples. So let me do another small example. three-player Coon Poker, which is, again, this tiny little card game with four cards in it. We've actually completed the whole space, or a very large space of possible Nash equilibrium. We know actually all the Nash equilibrium in the game for the most part. There might be a few that we're missing because I don't think we've proven it's exhaustive, but we know a very large family of Nash equilibria. And in fact, what we know about this family of the strategies is that one of the players basically, there's really only one player in this family that has much choice, and their choice gets to decide whether it's player one who makes a lot of money or player three who makes a lot of money. He has no real control over their own payoff in the Nash equilibrium. Can only really swing the money between the two players. So I could see that. I mean, that is suggestive that at these small games that maybe you could actually just choose to say, look, I'm just going to play to make sure the money goes the other way. There's nothing you can do about it. The other thing I will say, and we've done this at Texas Hold'em, is I had a master's student who was looking at collusion. We were actually trying to see how could we build techniques to automatically identify collusion. So not collusion where someone might be sharing card information like on a side chat channel or something like that, but collusion where they're playing it straight up, but they were just planning to split the winnings afterwards. So they were, you know, not going to go at each other's throats and try to make money together. And so in order to try to explore this, we thought, well, if we're going to detect this, we need to actually have some data where we know that players are colluding. So let's start by building bots that collude, which was an interesting thing to start with. And so we took our techniques, and it was an easy adaptation to make them try to find strategies that are collusive. And it was quite amazing at how we could solve the game with different abstractions. We took a particularly weak abstraction and built players that colluded using this very weak abstraction. And they could actually win more money than a player with a very strong abstraction. So the collusive power was enough to take bad players, and if we call the abstraction level bad, and make them good. Now, on the other hand, like, they knew what they were doing. Like, they might not have known a lot about their cards, but they knew what they were doing about colluding. I think if bad players thought, I'm going to go out and collude now that you just told me this, I think bad players are also probably bad at colluding, but that's another issue.
Testify that you're correct about that.
So, but it is true that you can, it is very possible, and this was in Texas Hold'em, these were abstractions in Texas Hold'em, but it's very possible that players can hold strategies that can basically make it very, very hard, if not impossible, for another player sitting at the table to win.
So I would ask you a follow-up question, but I don't want to put you in the awkward situation of having to say no comments again, so I'll just hand the microphone back to Andrew here.
I mean, this is kind of a feature of any multiplayer game, isn't it, that collusive strategies are very often, optimal in the sense of best for the colluders?
Yeah, I think that's generally true, that again, it's a property that once you walk out of these two-player zero-sum very limited setting, lots of weird things can happen, and collusion is just one piece of it.
I came across something else in one of your papers. You were talking about the concept of I guess you would say perturbing your results or perturbing your strategies, where I think the specific example that you used was that you, when your programs were doing their training, you would give them some small additional reward for winning the pot beyond the actual size of the pot. And you were doing this to encourage like slightly more aggressive strategies than what would otherwise be produced. Did I summarize that reasonably?
Yeah, absolutely. We used that in 2007 for our first man versus machine match. And it was exactly that. We wanted to make more aggressive strategies. We were already decent at the time at making these, you know, approximations of Nash equilibria, but the feedback we got from our human pros that were testing it were just that the strategies were very passive. They weren't a challenge to play against. You know, that they didn't make mistakes, but they also didn't punish people when the people made mistakes. And so, yeah, we started solving these games where there was a 7% bonus that we added in for whoever won the game. Right, the other person didn't lose anymore. It's just extra money being tossed into the pot. And this worked really well. This gave us programs for heads-up limit that were very aggressive compared to what we had before.
And that was something that you did specifically to take advantage of a mistake that you thought human players were likely to make?
That was our feeling at the time. And even after that match, we talked a fair bit about why did it work so well, because that was the program that most of the two that Phil Locke and Ali Islami struggled the most with. Like, they played against both our passive program and they played against this aggressive one, and they struggled much more against the aggressive one. And we talked a little bit afterwards, and there's a couple of theories of why. I mean, one is poker players do make mistakes, and if they make a mistake, you know, 1% of the time, then the right way to exploit that is to get them to make as many decisions as you can, because that means on any given hand, they're more likely to have made a mistake if you get them to make more decisions. Mm-hmm. And so the one way to get someone to make more decisions is to raise at them. If you fold, of course, they don't get to make any mistakes. They don't have to play well after that. And if you call, you're shortening the game. And so in the limit games, what this aggressive strategy ended up doing was it did raise more, and the theory being that it just keeps pushing the human into more and more situations where maybe they'll make a mistake. Another theory at the time was that a lot of very, very aggressive play at the time was also associated with bad play. And here was a program that was being aggressive, but it was actually sort of a measured aggression because it had to solve one of these games. It was only 7%. It wasn't that far off from the real game. So it had to be more balanced. And maybe that style of play humans just hadn't seen before. And that was just new to them, and they didn't know how to deal with it. So they tried to approach it in the way you would normally approach just playing against a bad player. And that wasn't the right approach. What's interesting is about 3 years later, we developed the ability for the first time to check how close a strategy is to the Nash equilibrium of the full game. So we were building these exact Nash equilibrias to these toy games, to these abstract games, and we knew that they were basically exact equilibria in those abstract games. But because of abstraction process, they were not Nash equilibria of the full game. And we had no idea how far they were off. Like, we surmised that as we build bigger and bigger abstractions, they would be closer and closer to the Nash equilibrium of the full game. But we had no way of measuring it. And we finally developed a technique that would turn what seemed on the back of the paper computation, back of the envelope computation, to be 100 years down to we could do it in about a day across a cluster of machines. And we could answer the question, given a strategy, if someone could, you know, analyze that strategy as much as they wanted to and play perfectly against it to take every penny it's worth, how much could they take? And this was the stunning thing. We ran that against our normal strategy, where we didn't lie to it about its payoffs, and it was playing in an abstract game, and we computed the value, the exploitability of one of these aggressive ones. The aggressive one, where we lied to it about its payoffs, was less exploitable than the passive one. So somehow, and we have no explanation for this to this day, lying to the program about its payoffs hid errors that were introduced because of the abstraction process. So we know there are errors from the abstraction process, but somehow by lying to it, we are somehow compensating for those errors. And we don't have any explanation for that at all.
I'm really tempted to ask follow-up questions, but it seems like there's not really a lot more that you can say about that, huh?
You can ask the follow-up questions. I might just have to say I really don't
know. No, I mean, I guess the follow-up would just be like, what could possibly account for that?
I don't, maybe the answer is good. I remember going to one of our local resident experts who was really very forceful that our aggressive program was a good choice. And I asked them, can you clarify? Like, I hadn't told them the result that we had just discovered. Clarify for me. Did you think it was a good thing to do because it would be less exploitable? Or do you think it would be a good thing to do because it would be harder for humans to find out its exploitation? And he was like, no, it's definitely, like, it'll be more exploitable because you're lying to it about its payoff.
Right.
But it'll be harder for them to discover that exploitation. And I'm like, guess what? That's not true. I mean, we've continued to play around with that a little bit. I don't know what here's one lesson. Maybe I'll throw this out there as the why could this possibly be true. I'll give one guess that we've had. We don't know as much about our cards. And maybe as a result of not knowing as much about our cards, because we have abstraction, we're stuck being more uncertain than we really should be. And so maybe our strategies end up being slightly more passive than the real game strategies would be because they know less. And so then by this sort of artificially saying, no, be aggressive because we just want you to, it gets to cover up that fact. Now, the counter to that is, well, we're actually playing a game where both players don't know much about their cards. Why would that make you more passive if neither player knows much about their cards? And I don't know.
Is there not a way to test this, like with a toy game, where you do have a better idea of the perfect solution to, you know, to then try introducing a slightly more aggressive version of the strategy and see, like, I don't even know where exactly I would go from there, but
it's kind of, yeah, we can do that, and we do that sometimes in smaller games that we can solve exactly. And in the small games, adding the bonus, right, making the more aggressive strategies does make them more exploitable. It's usually pretty small. Like when we did the 7% bonus, that took us from being unexploitable up to being exploitable for 35 milliblinds, right, where a human expert's trying to win about 50. So it opens up a little bit of a hole, but not a huge one.
Have we ever, though, taken a small toy game, did abstraction even though we don't need to do it, and then asked, can we fix the abstraction holes by adding aggression through this line to its best payoffs? And that's what I was thinking when you asked the question.
That's what I meant to ask, just in a more articulate way.
I think we've never ran that experiment. So when you were asking it, I was going,
yeah,
huh,
that's interesting.
That's a good experiment. We'll have to go run that. So no, I don't know if the same thing, the same result holds at smaller scale.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, I did want to say, I'm far from the caliber of player that I know you've worked with in the past, but I find all of this really interesting. And if you all ever find yourself in need of wanting to get the opinion of a poker player, I'd be more than happy to volunteer myself for that task if you're ever trying to bounce ideas for whatever reason.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, and the same goes for me, although I think you want to work with me less than you want to work with Andrew, because he's a lot better than I am. So that's
one of the things we can do with our programs is I had mentioned that we do duplicate, where what you do is you swap the cards and have the same programs playing, but with the opposite sides of the cards. One of the things you can do with humans is you can have two humans play against a computer program, but they get dealt the exact same cards. So now in a very much smaller number of hands, the question is who could take the most from the computer program given the exact same set of cards being dealt.
Right.
If you're interested, we could set you guys up and you guys could have a little competition.
I would love
that.
Yeah,
I think that sounds like fun.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I know we've kept you about as long as we said we would keep you. Can I ask one very different last question? Or unless Andrew has more questions. Do you like poker more or less or the same as you did before you spent so much time studying it?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's kind of funny. So in our research group, we have, how many people do we have now? 8 people?
Yeah.
2 professors, 6 students. And that number kind of goes up and down over the years. I've been with the group since about 2006. And over that time, we usually have about half the students that really like poker and are interested in AI. And the other half, you know, really love AI and kind of get interested in poker. At least for me, I'm one of the ones that was more about AI, and I think in my entire life I've played maybe tops 100 hands of poker. Most of that was I had a job interview years ago at an online casino, and I decided to go play some play money before I went, just so I could say that I had used the software. I ran out of play money fast. So yeah, I've definitely learned to appreciate the game. I know enough to know that I'm terrible at it. I'll probably never be a good player, but it's still, you know, fun to write the program that can play.
Cool. Yeah, okay. I'm probably in the same category that Michael's in. While I lead the poker group now, I didn't start it. It was actually started by Dr. Jonathan Schaefer. I actually arrived as a faculty member after it had been around for about 6 years. The group had been around. And so when I arrived here at the University of Alberta, I thought this was the coolest project that was happening at the university. And I knew I wanted to get involved into it. So at the time I actually sat down and started playing. We would play sort of occasionally recreationally with friends, but not very often. And so I sort of seriously started like playing against the programs that existed at the time just to see, you know, whether I could beat them. That was kind of my challenge. I couldn't even beat them back in 2003. I think over time though, as I've now studied it, I've actually gotten less interested in playing the game. I think it's partially because I know what I should be thinking about, and I don't want to be thinking about those things.
That's very much my poker experience as well. Is there anything more that you guys wanted to talk about that we didn't have the wherewithal to ask you?
I can't think of anything.
All right. Well, thank you again for doing this. This has really been fascinating for me, and I think it will be for our listeners as well. I'd love to take you up on that offer to play against the program. So I'll be in touch with you about that.
Okay. You're very welcome. We enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you.
It'd be great. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very, very much. It's really, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good night, gentlemen.